If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
Finally, sunscreen worthy of your skin. Sol de Janeiro's new Rio Radiance SPF 50 collection, where glowing hydration meets sun protection in a beachy and nostalgic scent. Confidently embrace your glow with lightweight 100% mineral SPF body lotion, refreshing SPF body spray, and shimmering SPF body oil. Receive 10% off on your first order on soldejaneiro.com, plus free shipping with the code SPOTIFY10.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The bubble economy is gone. So are the savings of millions of Americans. But the Wall Street and financial sector money elite who helped build the bubble aren't giving their bonuses back. And those packages were huge. Now some are asking if they gave the wrong incentives and helped wreck the economy. This hour, On Point, reconsidering the giant bonuses of Wall Street, the huge pay, and where it brought us. You can join the conversation. Did you see the huge payouts as just an efficient market at work? Do you still? Did we get the incentives right? Can that case still be made? Joining me first today from Washington is Louise Story, business reporter for the New York Times. Her big story last week was headlined, Wall Street Profits Were a Mirage, but Huge Bonuses Were Real. Louise, thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom.
So what's the dynamic we're talking about here? How big the bonuses, how big bad the mirage?
Well, the bonuses were huge. 2006 was the biggest year, but they've been growing for many years before that. For example, at Goldman Sachs in 2006, there were more than 50 people who were paid more than $20 million. So that's more than $1 billion for 50 people. But what we're also talking about is 2006 was a year that profits were the biggest across the banks that they'd ever been. And that's why there were these big bonuses, because the profits were so big. What we now know, though, is those profits were not real. All of the write-downs we've had in the last 2 years have wiped out the supposed profits from 2006.
And now the National Treasury has stepped in an enormous way to help bail out a lot of these firms. Some of them are gone. Tell us the story, if you would, of Stanley O'Neill and Dow Kim, two of the big bonus recipients with Merrill Lynch, Louise.
Yes. They were both behind the drive to expand the mortgage operations at Merrill Lynch. And by 2006, Merrill had come out of nowhere to become one of the leaders in mortgage CDOs, which are collateralized debt obligations. They're bundles of mortgages. And Merrill was producing the most of anyone. And what they did in 2006 is they bought a mortgage originator named First Franklin so that they could bundle those mortgages into CDOs. So they kept this engine roaring even as other banks started pulling back. And because they kept it roaring, they were taking on mortgages that were not good. At the end of 2006, with these record profits, O'Neill, the CEO of Merrill Lynch, and Dow Kim, who was a co-president, were paid out the highest bonuses at the bank, and they were enormous. Dow Kim, for example, got $35 million. $14 million of that was in cash, and that was just for a single year.
And O'Neill, how did he end up? Because, of course, the end of this story is Merrill Lynch goes under or is sold to Bank of America. Where does the story end on the bonus front there?
Well, I mean, Stan O'Neill just that year got nearly $45 million. When he left Merrill Lynch, he was booted the following year. He got an exit package of $117 million. And of course, in the years before 2006, he got very generous bonuses as well.
Louise, we all know that the federal government has had to step in for the financial services sector in an enormous way. There was a lot of talk when that happened, when the $700 billion was voted through Congress. about some kind of control on compensation in these industries. Where does that stand?
That's right. There were rules put in place about how much money you could pay the top five executives at the banks in the future, you know, this year and next year. But there was nothing in there about money that was paid out 2-3 years ago when these mistakes were made. There was nothing in there about taking money back that was paid for bad investments. There was also nothing in there about how much you paid to people lower down the ranks. Remember, on Wall Street, it's not just the CEO that makes a lot of money. It's traders and bankers, people you've never heard of, who could be 30 years old making $15 million.
And now I'm reading in the Washington Post last week, Amit Paley had a story there saying that the pay limits may prove toothless, that the $700 billion that went through with the requirements of some oversight on pay, those may have been gutted by some language changes at the last minute. What do you know about that, Louise?
I do know that there was there were some legal memos that were floated around in the last minute pointing out that there was not very much teeth in the rules, and in fact, a lot of people think that it didn't really go very much above and beyond the rules put in place by Sarbanes-Oxley, which, of course, you know, the banks already had to follow. So a lot of people think there's not very much teeth. This year alone, though, not because of those rules, but because of the public scrutiny, the top executives at banks are not being paid much. In fact, almost every CEO on Wall Street has said that he will not take a bonus at all this year. So for this year, you know, they're really kind of taking one for the team. But the real question is, what happens going forward to pay up and down all the lines of the ranks of the banks, and how does their pay affect the decisions they make, particularly when times get better? You know, is it going to encourage them to make bad decisions again?
So at this point, really not clear whether the financial services industry, Wall Street, might try to go right back to the same old bonus merry-go-round?
Well, if you worked in Wall Street and you were there in large part to make a lot of money and big profits came back, wouldn't you want a big bonus?
If it was there to be had, human nature is to take it.
That's right.
Louise Story with the New York Times, thank you very much for your reporting and thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Joining me now from Tel Aviv is Lucian Bebchuk. He's a professor of law, economics, and finance at Harvard Law School and director of their program on corporate governance. His book out in 2004 was Pay Without Performance, The Unfulfilled Promise of Executive Compensation. Lucian Bebchuk, thank you very much for being here.
Great to be here.
What are we learning about how the American financial services industry compensated those working in its ranks? And I mean, can we look back now and say we had the incentives somehow wrong?
Yes, this was actually a main point of the book that you mentioned. Mm-hmm. At the time, Jesse Fried and I argued very strongly that the incentives were too much focused on the short term. They were giving incentives to pay less attention to long-term returns. And unfortunately, we have learned that that's very much the case. I think that now even some of the investment banks admit that incentives were too much focused on the short term, and some of them are trying to make changes. But unfortunately, we are closing the doors of the barn after so many horses are left already.
But what we were told again and again then was the global economy is changing, rich rewards are flowing naturally by the hand of the market to those at the top, those who are handling a lot of this money. This is the market at work, and it's a good thing.
But it's a market that has a lot of imperfections. It's not really a well-functioning market. To begin with, the people at the very top, we don't really have true arm's-length bargaining between them and the company, and therefore their structure of incentive is not perfectly aligned with shareholders. And once the people at the top don't have the right incentives, then you can just expect that the people below them will not have the right incentives, and you can expect that the whole organization will be focusing on the short term.
Well, we've seen some very tough criticism in recent days. Paul Krugman, recent Nobel Prize-winning economist, columnist at the New York Times, asking, how different really is Mr. Madoff, as in Bernie Madoff, Mr. Madoff's tale from the story of the investment industry as a whole? So the end result was the same. The money managers got rich. The investors saw their money disappear. Is that too harsh?
Paul puts it with his great flair and wonderful style. I think that we do need, I agree that we do need to have serious rethinking about the size of the financial sector in the economy. Over the last 50 years, the size of GDP that is allocated to the financial sector went up three times, from 2.3% to 7.7%. There is a recent study that shows that just looking at Harvard College graduates, in 1970, 5% of them ended up in finance. The class of 1990, 15%, three times as many, ended up in finance. So we had kind of a huge fraction of the economy and of the talent going into finance. And at least looking at the last 10 years, the results have not been very good. I looked earlier today at a standard ETF that tracks the financial sector. Mm-hmm. And over the last 10 years, the financial sector has lost somewhat more than 50%, 5-0, of total value over the long 10-year period. So a lot of value has been destroyed rather than created.
A lot of brain power into this one industry or sector, and a lot of billions now lost there, even as huge, huge bonuses were made. Lucian Bebchuk, please stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking back this hour on a decade and more of giant bonuses on Wall Street. Huge pay. What it brought us and where it stands now. We've been joined by Lucian Bebchuk, author of Pay Without Performance. He's in Tel Aviv today. He's professor of law, economics, and finance at Harvard Law. We'll expand our circle of observers here in just a moment, but let's get some calls first. Greg, in Ames, Iowa, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hey, we've been hearing a lot about all the past bonuses and how big they are, mm-hmm. but I think the envelopes with the bonuses for this Christmas are already gone out, or maybe they're going out.
Well, and we've been hearing some top CEOs are not taking them this year, but that's not the picture all across the entire board.
Right, right. So I'm wondering how much, if anybody's done an analysis of how much, how big, what's the total amount of bonuses that are being paid to companies who have taken bailout money? Could it be that's anywhere close to the $13 billion that the president has just begrudgingly given the auto industry?
It is an interesting question. Lucian Bebchuk, do you have any idea? We heard from Louise Story, the New York Times, some prominent high-tier CEOs in the financial sector not taking bonuses this year. But what's the picture across the board? Do you know, Lucian? And what about federal money in there?
We don't have yet the full numbers, but the understanding is that some bonuses are being paid. Last year, around $40 billion were paid in bonuses. So even if bonuses decline by 60%, still we can expect roughly $16 billion to be paid this year.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But as Luis stressed in the beginning, we did have some CEOs forgoing their bonuses this year. But to put it in the broader picture, the fact that they gave up their bonuses of this year, but they kept all the bonuses they were paid in the last several years, it means that they are still very much ahead in a big way vis-a-vis their shareholders, that over the last several years, they still have made a lot of money as a result of managing the companies, even though they were presiding over an aggregate decline in shareholder wealth.
What turned out to be a disaster for many of their shareholders, not to mention a whole lot of other Americans. Let's go to Walter in Providence, Rhode Island. Walter, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I think that this whole problem is really twofold. One, it's the sheer greed that went on. All of these investment bankers, CEOs, boards of director people know what probably most sixth graders know. You don't put all your eggs in one basket, no matter how attractive the basket. And these guys, out of sheer greed, they're probably guilty of criminal neglect by investing the firm's money to the point where it risked the very existence of the firm. They're not stupid, so they must be just sheer greed.
Yeah, we got it.
And I think the other part of it is that the regulation, probably going back to the Reagan era, including Clinton, and right on through up to now, has been lax. And it's still lax. They're writing huge checks to these companies with no accountability, never mind performance. And I think that if you're just a mortgage broker, you know, a 30-year-old mortgage broker, somebody comes in, applies for a mortgage. If you're not held accountable for the client that you provide the mortgage to, for his credit, his or her credit rating, and so forth, you just get a commission and you're all done, and mortgage is sold off.
Never mind the top executive who puts together $500 million of those mortgages, or did maybe, in a bundle that turns out to be something like worthless. Walter, thanks for calling. I want to bring another voice in here right now from Tucson, Arizona. We're joined by Stephen Kaplan, professor of entrepreneurship and finance at the University of Chicago Business School. Stephen Kaplan, thanks very much for being there.
You're welcome, Tom.
It's great to have you. We've been talking with Louise Story at the Times and Lucian Bebchuk. You know, he's been critical of Wall Street pay and bonuses over the years. You have been generally supportive, saying, look, the market is pushing the compensation to this point. It's doing the right thing. We're fine here. Do you still feel that way, Professor Kaplan, when you look at all the damage that's out there to these companies themselves and beyond?
So I think the answer is going to be nuanced. I think I will agree with Lucian that there were mistakes were made. There's no question. And there were incentives that could have been better. On the other hand, I will disagree and stick to what you just said, that there were real reasons for this to happen. There were, you know, a number of surprises that drove this. And I think the real question is, going forward, what do you do? And I think you can say there were, you know, things went wrong, but going forward, do you change or do you let the markets work? And I think on Lucian's point that there were inappropriate incentives, I think that's not quite right. If you look at the CEOs of these top firms, the Richard Fuld of Lehman, the Jimmy Cain of Bear Stearns, Stan O'Neill at Merrill Lynch, they lost hundreds of millions of dollars in this debacle because they did own a lot of stock. The pay practices on Wall Street were to take your bonus and put a lot of it in stock. And I think Louise Story said that earlier, that the majority of what they were paid did go into stock. And all of these people, along with the shareholders, lost a huge amount of money. If they could have done it differently, if they had known what was going on, they would have done it differently. And I think you can bet they will do it differently in the future.
Well, I wonder. I mean, I read Louise very closely in the case, for example, of Dow Kim, who put together a lot of those mortgage bundles for Merrill Lynch. Yes, a bunch was in stock, but many, many millions were in cash. Cash that he and others are still hanging on to. You may have heard our caller Walter saying, you know, there's something wrong when guys who are supposed to be this smart engage in risk to the point of risking their firms itself, not to mention the shareholders and right behind it the whole economy here. I mean, you seem to be putting that in the category of nuance, but aren't we paying a pretty terrible price?
We are paying a price. Let me make three points. Point number one, I agree with you. There were incentives in place to make short-term bets, and you got paid on them, mm-hmm. and that was a mistake. And that, I predict, will not happen in the future. And I think you've seen that with Credit Suisse's bonus plan, where they are putting plans in place that do exactly what Lucian talked about. I think second, the point that is the market point is there was fierce competition for people like this at the time. And hedge funds were, you know, out there hiring the best and the brightest. And if you wanted to keep what you thought were your good people, you had to pay them. And a third point I'll mention, look at nobody talks about law firms. Law firms today, if you look at what top partners make at the top law firms, it's seven-figure incomes. And the law firms were there saying that these deals were good and helping the companies. And the law firms clearly made huge mistakes. And I don't hear anybody saying we shouldn't pay $1,000 an hour for these top lawyers because they made mistakes as well. The point is that these lawyers are valuable. And that's why people hire them, and they do get paid even today. And it's something where it is I don't know whether unpleasant is the right word, but it is something where people look at this and it's hard to understand. But there are people who are valuable and have markets, and that's what is happening.
Well, I'd say unpleasant, though, at this point sounds like too mild a word. I mean, you got millions and millions of people hurt. Lawyers, sure, maybe making money when the financial services industry made that much money. There's a kind of trickle down with the cup right next to those big bonuses. But if they had seven-figure, we saw a lot of eight-figure as well. I mean, you can't help wondering if still there's a germ of something wrong in the incentive, and if these were the best and the brightest, how come we are as a country in such a terrible situation now? Let me get a call from Beverly, Massachusetts. Linda, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you, Tom, for taking my call. Mm-hmm. And I just want to reiterate something I had heard but had not yet heard about the financial institution. It's my impression that they maintain that they need to pay these top really high salaries in order to get the top talent and, again, what you had referred to as the best and the brightest, and somehow they are the center of the universe. Now, you know, I don't think anyone is so talented that they're worth that many millions of dollars. There are a lot of people who are equally talented who would take those jobs for a lot less.
Well, when you look at what happened to the companies they're employed by, they were, a number of them are now out of business. How best and bright is that, Lucian Bebchuk?
My question, how yes. could they be so much the best and the brightest? But my question that I called about is I would like to know, what are the avenues for the investors, both large and small, to recover some of their investments and to sue? And, you know, where do they stand in the queue to get some of their money back? You know, Madoff made off with a great deal of money. And one of the things I want to thank you for, you made it very, very clear to one of your callers who indicated that somehow that a lot of Jewish people were responsible for this because of the houses. But, you know, you made it clear that there were as many Jewish institutions, if not more Jewish institutions, that suffered as a result.
All kinds of people involved in these industries, no question, Linda. But thank you for your call. And let me take the specific question. I guess there's two. Lucian Bebchuk, how do you look at this? First of all, if these were the best and brightest, why are things in such a terrible situation now? And Linda asks, is there some, you know, a lot of these bonuses, value has been lost, as Stephen Kaplan says, in what they took in stock, certainly, but there was a lot of cash there, too. Is there a legal avenue to grabbing some of this back? Should the country, investors, be looking at that as a way of clawing back some of these enormous bonuses that were paid?
Okay. With respect to the latter, unfortunately, it would be very difficult, if not impossible, to get back the money. The top executives, perhaps due to social pressure, but most of the money that was just given to people below them, they are legally entitled to it because of the arrangements that were in place. Those were unfortunate and regrettable, but it would be difficult to get the money back. I wanted to give some quick reactions to what Steve said. Mm-hmm. I agree that it's difficult to tell how much what we had has been the result of innocent mistakes and surprises. But what's unfortunate is that the compensation schemes we had, rather than penalizing those sort of mistakes, encouraged them and provided an incentive to engage in short-term bets. Secondly, Steve mentioned the fact that the CEOs, like the Bear Stearns CEO and the Lehman Brothers CEO, mm-hmm. lost a lot of money. Mm. But it's still the fact that if you look at what has happened to the shareholders lost everything, and they still came out with a substantial amount of money from their period of running the companies, which means that we didn't have an alignment of their interests and the shareholders' interests. And lastly, we do have a market, and we need to retain people, and perhaps we sometimes need to pay them a substantial amount. But that does not mean that we should pay them in inefficient ways, in ways that provide perverse incentives.
Let me get a call from Steve in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Steve, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm calling about Bloomberg reporting last week that Credit Suisse is compensating their executives with mortgage-backed security, you know, these worthless mortgage-backed securities now. I think that's a great model for a number of reasons, you know, one of which being it gets this stuff off their books. And
let them eat their own cooking, in a way.
That's right. And, you know, we're all eating their cooking with all these bailouts now. As a taxpayer, I'd like to see that model extended to every company that's had a bailout, and even people in the administration that want to buy all this stuff up. So that includes AIG, which last week lost $30 billion in the credit default swap market. I think if there was some way to get Paulson or even Bush paid in this stuff, I think that'd be great.
What, pay everybody in the same thing that came tumbling down? It doesn't sound like much of an incentive to keep working on it, but there's a kind of reality check there. Stephen Kaplan, what do you make of UBS, Credit Suisse, I guess, paying in essentially junk, like, you know, hard-to-sell junk bonds, their bonuses this year?
I thought it was very clever and very appropriate, just as Steve from Cambridge said. If the stuff turns out to be worth anything, great. And if it's not, then, as you said, they eat your own cooking. Two other things in that plan which were very nice and which I'm sure Lucian agrees it was a good thing is if some of those results turn out not to be have been correct, there's a clawback. So even if it is junk, they'll have to give it back. And then the second thing is that they were also given some of the bonus and restricted stock that, again, they can't sell for some time. So it was, I think, a very clever plan, and it would not be a bad thing if other firms did the same thing.
But at the moment, they're pretty much alone as far as I can tell. Eating one's own cooking is not that attractive when the risks of it not being there for those bonus recipients are clearly so large.
But it aligns. I mean, it's a good idea. It aligns incentives. And, we'll see if others follow.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking back this hour on a decade and more of giant bonuses on Wall Street. Huge pay, what it brought us, and where it stands now. Stephen Kaplan joins us from the University of Chicago Business School. Lucian Bebchuk is here, author of Pay Without Performance. Bob in Buffalo, New York. You're on the air, Bob.
Hi, Tom. Great program. The other night on ABC News, I think Charlie Gibson was saying that Morgan Stanley received $10 billion in the bailout money and paid $2 billion in bonuses. Bank of America received $10 billion, and they spent $10.9 billion in bonuses. It's like, wow, how come they can do this? And nobody, doesn't anyone in those positions have any sense of responsibility or for what they've helped create and feel like, geez, maybe we shouldn't take these money for bonuses?
There have been some changes in policy. We've heard about some of them this morning, but still, there's people wondering, just like you, Bob, with all that public money in there, what about bonuses now? Lucian Bebchuk, do you see pay practices changing as a result of the crisis that we're in now, or is this just a pause? Is there even a pause?
There are some changes. We still don't know whether they are merely cosmetic and they will be abandoned later on, and we don't know how broad. But what is important to understand is, or to focus on, is the fact that those things are happening just now after this huge crisis and huge destruction of value. And the reason is that the problems that they are trying to rectify, those are things that have been visible. Connecting compensation to long-term value, to me, it's a no-brainer. It's not something that companies should have adopted now. It's something that they could have adopted years ago. People, including us in our book, have been advocating this, and it's a very straightforward and sensible approach, which to me suggests that we have to be concerned about decision-making and corporate governance problems at, you know, publicly traded companies, and to be concerned as to whether they are managed in a way that is optimal for shareholders.
Let's go to Louise in Northampton, Massachusetts. Louise, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Every time I hear you talk about these guys, you always refer to them as the best and the brightest.
Not me today, my friend. Not me today. That's Stephen Kaplan's phrase today.
Okay, sorry. But I think it's not that they are the best and the brightest or that they were the best and the brightest. I think it's a combination of maybe the best self-promotion and maybe the best accomplishment at selling this idea that they were the best and the brightest, combined with government policies that allowed this mess to be created. And I don't think that we can actually start unraveling what really went on and who they are without sort of debunking or actually looking at this mythology, this self-created mythology, that they were the best and the brightest.
You know, I think that's a great point. Stephen Kaplan, how about it? I mean, what kind of genius is it that takes a big company and reduces its value to near zero or puts it out of business? And what about all the shareholder and 401k and retirement money that's lost with that? Did somehow the bonuses themselves lead us to warp or narrow down the way we understand best and brightest, the way we understood geniuses? Paul Krugman wrote, "The vast riches being earned undermined our sense of reality and degraded our judgment." Might that extend to exactly how we defined genius or bright here?
Well, first of all, I think it was Lucian's term, best and brightest, but there's no doubt very talented people, people who were at our most prestigious institutions flocked to Wall Street, and it is clear they made lots of mistakes. And
so, how bright is that?
System did, but let me sort of broaden this a little bit. Mm-hmm. This is not just the United States. This is a global phenomenon. And
but a lot of it started right here, right on Wall Street,
started,
right in those
but it,
big bundles.
It's happened everywhere. And some places the compensation was short term. Again, as I said earlier, in other companies, the executives had a lot of money in the stock of their companies, and it didn't help because of what happened underneath. And they got it wrong. And I think, going back to your earlier question, going forward, I think the practices will be improved, and it will make it harder to happen again. But the fact is, it did happen, and people made mistakes, and these people were very, at least on objective measures, appeared to be very, very smart people.
But I'm struck by Louise's question or suggestion that we may have to come to a new understanding of what best and brightest means if this is what it's produced. Let's go to Mary in Woodbury.
Can I just say one more thing? The one thing that is also people have not focused on at all in what is a terrible economy and a downturn is a lot of positive has come out of the last 20 or 25 years and this move to capital markets and free markets. If you look around the world, there are more people above the poverty level around the world than ever before. It's been unbelievable what has happened in places like India and China and even Africa. Life expectancies in every region in the world have gone up in the last 15 or 20 years. And I think some of that ought to be, if not a large part of it, ought to be credited to the move to markets and the moving of capital and technology around the world, which to some extent has been accelerated by the people on Wall Street, London, and by the financial markets.
You can certainly make that observation, but then you've got to also give credit to other factors involved there, and you've got to look at responsibility for the
absolutely.
Bubble factor that is now bringing so much of that down. Let's go to Mary in Woodbury, Vermont. Mary, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I guess I'm very curious to hear feedback on from your guests on the difference between mistakes and calculated risks that were so reckless. You know, I worked at Standard & Poor's in the mid-90s, mm-hmm. and I can't tell you how many derivative workshops we went to that were so complicated and so complex. But because there was no empirical evidence that they wouldn't work, they go ahead with these things.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like they're not really mistakes. These guys are risk takers. That's what they're trained to do. They go for blood. It's in their culture. This is not a mistake. Their risks went down, and there's no accountability.
And risks that took us right out to the edge and over. Lucian Bebchuk, what do you say to Mary's observation?
I agree that when you see results in financial economics, we tend to think that you should expect to get what you pay for, that people by and large respond to incentives. And, you know, let me, by the way, take responsibility for the best and brightest term that everybody has been running away from this program. So there is a sense in which those were extremely talented people. We know that top college graduates across the nation, talented, hardworking, have been going into finance. So when we see the results, I don't think that we should revise our assessments of their IQ and hard work. Rather, we know that even when they are very good people, when you have distorted incentives, you can get very poor results. So to me, the inference or the thing that a financial economist should focus on is the concern that we had bad incentives of the kind I mentioned before mm-hmm. at work, which channeled this talent that was there in directions that didn't turn out to be productive.
But that's the very point of the scale of these bonuses and compensation packages, so big that they could warp people's judgment or incent them toward unjustified risk. And if you look at results, it certainly looks as though it was not justified. Let's go to Harrisonburg, Virginia. Lori, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to say that I get tired of hearing about greed and always greed. I think that there's always greed in the human nature. What we have here is a lack of regulation due to deregulation and globalization for the complication of the markets and so on. And, you know, I'm tired of hearing, you know, this is, we keep blaming the corporate leaders and this kind of stuff. I think that the people of the United States allowed this to happen. And we have to remember that we make the regulations and that we can regulate these markets. The markets don't have a mind of their own, that we're, you know, we're the boss of them. And we need to return to fairness, which is not socialism. And I was wondering if your guests could speak to how how this can change. How can we return to fairness and transparency in the markets, if there's a hope for that?
I'll put it to both of them, and thank you very much, Lori. Stephen Kaplan, how about it? You support the market, yet you sound open to change today, and clearly we've got a mess in our hands at the moment. Is there a way to better structure incentives and regulation so that we don't repeat this?
I think rules clearly matter and regulation matters. I think, ironically, many of the companies that failed were heavily regulated. It'd be true of some of the banks that failed. It'd be true of the banks in Europe that have also had trouble. And it's also true of the investment banks. So it wasn't that there wasn't regulation. It was just poor regulation. I think one of the things that has come out of this is banks are going to be required to be more capitalized, and the investment banks in particular got very, very leveraged, and the government allowed that, and I think that is now gone, as the investment banks that have survived have now become commercial banks, which will require them to have more equity or more capital to offset risky positions.
And what about more broadly? I mean, you're a University of Chicago market guy, but after what we've seen in the last year, do you ever lie awake at night, you know, second-guessing yourself on that, wondering, you know, did we take this sort of market philosophy too far? Is the pain now too deep, the destruction of value too deep? Do we need to sort of reset our national understanding of how much we depend on, rely on that market dynamic that you've championed?
I do lie awake at night, and what is going on now in the economy is awful. That said, you know, the real question is, what is your alternative? And I think the alternative, number one, of requiring more capital in these institutions that take risk is likely a good one and is happening. The second point is, when markets and people make mistakes, they tend not to make the same mistakes again. And I think I would be more optimistic about how incentives will change in the future, just because the top executives at all of these companies, if they knew back then what was going to happen, believe me, they would have changed what they were doing. And I think you'll see going forward more plans like the Credit Suisse plan, where there is more accountability and more alignment. And I would prefer to see the markets figure that out with good rules and good capitalization until you tell me a better plan from the government, which I, you know, haven't necessarily seen.
You may be right, but we just did have back-to-back bubbles on the learning curve front. We just had, you know, bust and then bust again. Let's go to Tricia in Wayland, Massachusetts. Tricia, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom.
Hi.
This is just about my father, who's 90 now, and mm-hmm. during the 60s started a financial corporation that ended up in offices around the world.
Mm-hmm.
He was never compensated on this level, but he never went to work one day where he wasn't trying to do his best for this company and to build it and, you know, to be fair in what they did.
What's he been saying about the bonuses and compensation out there now?
He is appalled. He cannot comprehend. You know, for someone like Bill Gates to make billions because he created a whole new industry,
mm-hmm.
fine, but an executive at a financial institution is an executive doing his job. He is not some wonder child. And I think the incentives of these huge salaries on Wall Street, the kids did come from college and they went, wow, I'm going to use my degree and I'm going to go make millions if I go to Wall Street. So the motivation was to make the money, not as my father's was, to build this corporation and provide this good financial services that he did. And I think it's totally backwards now. And, you know, my father had a reputation during the 70s when there was a credit crunch, and they had to get new funds. He went to a meeting of Canadian bankers, and he said, you know, I need more lines of credit, whatever it was. And one of the bankers didn't know him, and the guy next to him said, he gave my father's name, and he said, if he says this is what it is, it is. And on his bond, his word was his bond back then. That's the kind of person we should have, instead of somebody who says, I want to go to Wall Street and make millions.
Well, Tricia, I wish your dad had been keeping track, had a little power more lately. On the other hand, Bernie Madoff gave his word in his bond, too. So it's a tricky business out there, but we like the values that you describe right there. Thank you very much for calling. Lucian Bebchuk, we've just got a minute here. Do you see a new sensibility coming to bear here, or does the market ultimately just rev up again and run off and we're back in big bonuses and too much risk?
I hope that people like Steve who presents the dominant view in financial economics, that thinks the market can self-correct. And I hope that this view will revise. I belong to the, unfortunately, still a minority view that believes that we have kind of fundamental agency problems at the top. And it's not a consolation that people made one mistake and they are not going to repeat that mistake and they might make another type of mistake later on. The concern is, do they have the right incentives and are they sufficiently accountable? And the main thing to me, and we haven't talked much about this, is to give shareholders more rights so that the people at the top will become more accountable to shareholders and therefore more attentive to long-term share value.
Well, the issue certainly has everyone's attention now. We'll see how we come out on the other side of this. Lucian Bebchuk with Harvard Law School, author of Pay Without Performance. Thank you very much for joining us today, Lucian.
Thanks for having me.
And Stephen Kaplan, professor at the University of Chicago Business School. Professor Kaplan, thank you very much for your perspective.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.